This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
So welcome to this episode of the Urban Political podcast. Today we're talking about Murray Bookchin's book, The Next Revolution, and its relevance to new municipalism, municipalism more generally, and left and urban politics in historical and contemporary perspectives. We've few guests today, three guests. If you could briefly introduce yourselves for our listeners, that would be great. Perhaps starting with you, Blair, moving on to Hilary and then Kate.
Sure. First, thanks to Ross and Marcus for putting this together and to Hilary and Kate for agreeing to be part of this panel. I'm really looking forward to it. It's a great conversation. So my name is Blair Taylor. I'm the program director of the Institute for Social Ecology. I live in Bremerton, Washington, about an hour west of Seattle. And I was the co-editor, along with Debbie Bookchin, of the book we're discussing today, The Next Revolution. I think I'll leave it at that for now.
Okay. So my name is Hilary Wainwright. I'm based in the East End of London, and I come from the north of England. I am just thinking what's relevant. I suppose most relevant is that I worked for the Greater London Council. That was the government of London before Mrs. Thatcher abolished it in the early 80s. I've written quite a few books, and some of them are about feminism and democracy and feminism and socialism. Some are about new kinds of trade unionism, and some are about municipal socialism. And my latest one is called A New Politics from the Left, which is particularly through the lens of knowledge and the importance of practical and tacit and popular knowledge.
I'm Kate Chabert. I'm originally from London, hence the accent, but I've been living in Barcelona for the last 12 years. And for the past 5 years, I've been a member of the municipalist platform Barcelona en Comú, which is currently in the city government with Mayor Ada Colau.
Okay, thanks everyone. So to get us started today, Blair, would you like to, could you give us a bit of background on Murray Bookchin's work generally, how you became too involved in this project, The Next Revolution, and why you think it's relevant perhaps to new municipalism politics more generally?
Okay. Yeah, it's hard to condense Murray's life and work, since he was spent a lifetime on the left and he wrote 25 books on political theory, radical history, urbanism, ecology, philosophy. But essentially, you know, he was a red diaper baby, grew up in the radical communist milieu of New York City in the Bronx. He was a young pioneer as a kid, like a street corner orator, became a Trotskyist in the 30s and then a labor organizer in the 40s, and then basically became quite disillusioned with the labor-oriented old left in the late 40s. He started exploring new traditions of utopianism, libertarian socialism. He was part of this group called Contemporary Issues in New York that was kind of clustered around a German emigre named Josef Weber that were reading Frankfurt School critical theory, anarchist stuff, pacifist stuff, and really trying to come up with new points of radicalism and conflict to kind of reorient a new kind of left. So he starts exploring, especially already in the early 50s, early mid-50s, ecology as a new source of radical energy. So in 1952, he writes a short article called The Problem of Chemicals and Food. And this really becomes kind of a launching off point where he's trying to come up with a new crisis dynamic that will, you know, create tensions with capitalism. The capitalism is destroying the environment. This creates a potentially trans-class revolutionary actor, because as a labor organizer, he saw, rather than the workers becoming kind of the grave diggers of capitalism, he saw them becoming more and more inured to capitalism. So this prompted a real rethink on his part. So he's trying to articulate a new politics, and then along comes the new left in the early 60s, which, you know, has a critique, a very broad, expansive critique, not only of class exploitation, but of hierarchy, alienation. It emphasizes democracy and post-scarcity. So this is kind of a perfect audience for his attempts to articulate a new left politics. At this time also, he publishes his first book-length work on ecology, Our Synthetic Environment, in 1962, which is 6 months before Rachel Carson's canonical Silent Spring that kind of kicks off the modern environmental movement. And then he writes a series of articles kind of directed at the new left, one called Ecology and Revolutionary Thought in 1964, which is really one of the the earliest articulations of a kind of left ecological politics. It's a pretty remarkable document for a variety of reasons, one of which is it predicts global warming in very concrete terms. Of course, he says it's going to happen 200 years in the future, and of course, we're living it now. But in any case, he's really trying to articulate a different kind of left politics with coordinates of democracy, ecology, prefiguration. And these are very heretical ideas at the time. Even very unorthodox leftists like the Situationists mock him. They call him the Smokey the Bear anarchist. And as SDS kind of evolves from talking about participatory democracy to Maoism, he writes a series of polemics, including one great one called Listen Marxist. But he's kind of, polemicizing against the turn away from participatory democracy into kind of what he feels are kind of older, more outdated political ideologies that aren't suited to the moment at hand. So these are collected in his book, Post-Scarcity Anarchism in 1971, which becomes kind of a classic rearticulation of anarchism that kind of, draws out this nascent critique of all forms of oppression and domination, ties it together in a lens of hierarchy and embeds it in a politics of direct democracy. Of course, those politics go more or less unheeded. He was there at the last SDS Congress in 1969, handing out copies of this polemic. But he would somewhat be vindicated, 30 years later with the rise of the ultra-globalization movement, when these kind of prefigurative forms of decentralized, ecological, directly democratic politics become more hegemonic. And this, of course, there's a big gap there that leads us through the new social movements of the 70s and 80s. During this time, he really is focusing on articulating social ecology as a body of ideas, the core insight of which is that the ecological problems must be understood as social problems, as emanating from the way our society is structured, namely one geared around domination, hierarchy, and exploitation. So in 1980, he publishes his kind of magnum opus, The Ecology of Freedom, which is a sprawling counter-theorization to Marx's Kapital that says rather than history being the history of class struggle, of course it's that, but it's also a history of other forms of domination, of racism, of sexism, of statist elites, et cetera. So he tries to kind of out-Marx Marx and paint class struggle as one particular instance of a broader dynamic. So this becomes kind of the basis for his work to come. Important to this, of course, is he really enunciates this ecological critique of capitalism that understands it as a grow or die logic that will inevitably, basically put humanity out of business. And that this also produces new radical subjectivities, to potentially trans class issue that we all have a stake in, potentially. He would later kind of back off from this. So he's involved in the new social movements in the 70s and 80s, the Clamshell Alliance, anti-nuclear movement, green movement. He founds the Institute for Social Ecology in 1974 with Dan Chodorkov, which is a radical education center that combines, radical theory, radical history with permaculture and hands-on agriculture, solar energy, things like this. During this time, he also has a series of debates with deep ecology and other forms of kind of what he believes are anti-humanist or Malthusian understandings of ecology. And he's really ahead of the curve here and predicting the kind of eco-fascist wave that we're seeing now, which has also long been kind of a preoccupation of social ecology, warning that ecology is not inherently left or liberatory politics, that it has a history of right interpretations, especially in National Socialism. But even within the quote-unquote, left or radical ecology movement, you saw people like Dave Foreman take racist anti-immigrant positions, anti-humanist positions that glorified HIV as thinning out the herd. So towards the end of his life, he's really kind of focused on debates within the anarchist movement. This is like the late 80s, early 90s. He's articulating an updated social anarchism, and he's engaged in fierce debates with other anarchist tendencies, post-left or lifestyle anarchists that want to cleanse the ism of anarchy that they understand is kind of the legacy of the left, and they want a much more individualistic, spontaneous, anti-organizational form of anarchism. He's saying this is a terrible mistake. On the other hand, he's debating people like John Zerzan, the anarcho-primitivist, who think it's not just capitalism and the state that's the problem, but rather technology, quote-unquote civilization, whatever that means, and calls for going back to hunter-gatherer society. So these debates kind of build up, and he breaks finally with anarchism in 1999, the tradition they've been working in for 40 or 50 years, ironically at the exact moment where a vision of anarchism very close to his own based on ecology, direct democracy is coming to the fore in the ultra-globalization movement, at least in North America, which things like the Direct Action Network were founded by people that were students of his and very indebted to his ideas. So he breaks with anarchism and he starts developing the body of ideas he eventually calls communalism, which is he's attempting to synthesize the anarchist, Marxist, and radical democratic traditions, saying that, you know, basically Marxism has had a too unproblematic relationship to the state and it leads to authoritarianism, whereas anarchism has been naive about power. The power exists and you can only hold it in common, you must democratize it. So he's trying to dialectically synthesize these two, and he lands on what he had been calling since the 60s the forms of freedom, popular assembly. It's this red thread that you can see throughout revolutionary history of self-managed organs of radical democracy that have been at the heart of most revolutionary movements. So he's saying this is what we should focus our energy on. This could be a form that is neither the party nor the kind of spontaneous and ephemeral street mobilization. So he's articulating this. He finally says, okay, you convinced me I'm not an anarchist. And then towards the end of his life, he really, he takes kind of a nostalgic turn. He works on a series of books called The Third Revolution, a four volume set that's basically analyzing the Western revolutionary tradition and trying to cull out some lessons. And he writes a series of articles. One that comes to mind is The Left That Was. It's really, in some ways, a rapprochement with the old left. And I think he, towards the end of his life, kind of realized that there were some things in the left that he helped bury that were actually really important and valuable. The need for organization, a commitment to some broad, you know, universalist enlightenment values of reason. So he really was kind of wistful. And the other thing that's also noticeable, I think, about his later works is he speaks very little about ecology in those days. He talks much more about capitalism and class struggle. So there seems to be, and he writes much more glowingly about Marx when in his earlier days he was highly, highly critical. So this is happening. He's in very poor health the last many years of his life. He also gets an interesting set of letters in the mail from some radicals in Kurdistan who are saying, we've been reading your work and we're really inspired by you. Could we have a dialogue? And he says, essentially, I'm too ill to do this. I'm that sounds great. I wish you the best. Well, of course, this was Abdullah Öcalan's, you know, YPG PKK organization or somewhere along that transformation, where essentially this movement that had began as a fairly traditional Marxist-Leninist national liberation movement, when their leader Abdullah Öcalan was imprisoned, he started reading new people, Emmanuel Wallerstein, Michel Foucault, and importantly Murray Bookchin, and abandoned this idea that a people that is spread across Iran, Iraq, Syria, and that they need their own state. What they need instead is what they call democratic confederalism. They need decentralized forms of multi-ethnic and importantly feminist rule. So of course this pops onto the popular consciousness in the wake of the Syrian civil war, when Rojava and Kobani become the symbol of the fight against ISIS on the one hand and our strange erstwhile allies. And yet at the same time, they're articulating this revolutionary new society in the middle of a war zone, which is quite an interesting irony, given that Bookchin was often both lauded and criticized as a utopian thinker. And the place where his ideas have received their fullest articulation is, in fact, quite a dystopian war zone. So it's a very unlikely case of intellectual political transference. So just to wrap up, he becomes an important point of reference for the kind of new municipalist politics, a right to the city movement. And in retrospect, we can see that he pioneered a bunch of positions that began as heretical: ecology, a non-reductive analysis of hierarchy and domination, directly democratic interpretation of anarchism, a focus on popular assemblies as counter-institutions of dual power. And these have become, you know, increasingly, arguably, really central to the left. So these, the essays in The Next Revolution, basically are kind of documenting and articulating the last 10, 15 years of his life, when he's really making this transition from anarchism to communalism and really trying to articulate his ideas. I got involved with the Institute in the wake of Seattle in 2000. I went out there. I studied for the next three summers. And basically it's become my kind of political and intellectual home since then. And it's provided this very unique space for, you know, movements to reflect and radical thinkers to think about praxis I worked at Verso Books at the time. I knew Debbie from the ISE, and we wanted to put something out that would reach new audiences. Bookchin's work had largely been kind of relegated to the anarchist and radical ecology movements. So that's how this came about, and it's been translated into 9 or 10 languages. And it's an attempt to give a general overview of his political philosophy, how it differs from anarchism and Marxism, answer some common objections to direct democracy, and to hopefully make a contribution to this kind of pendulum of the state and the streets that movements so often fall into that might, you know, offer some orientation to a more lasting and transformative politics.
Thanks, Blair. That was a really wonderful concise, but at the same time, expansive, if that makes any sense, expansive overview of his work. Kate, would you like to come in now and tell us about your own engagement with the book and perhaps how it relates to what's been going on in Barcelona and Spain and other places that have caught onto this label or generated this label of the new municipalism?
Sure, thank you. Well, actually, Blair's mentioned the Kurdistan Bookchin connection, but actually there's also another connection, which is the Barcelona Bookchin connection, because Murray Bookchin was very inspired by the Spanish anarcho-syndicalists, who were a real model of those forms of freedom for him. So, I mean, actually, I have to confess two things. One is that I came to the book New Revolution after I'd already started doing municipalism, after we won the election in 2015. And the other thing is that although Barcelona en Comú, when it was launched in 2014, from the very beginning identified as a municipalist movement, I'm not sure if many or any of the founders had actually read Murray Bookchin. But I say that not in any way to disparage him, but actually to say that firstly, they had that same local historical example that he was working from. But also that I think there's something about this kind of assembly-based local democracy model that is very human and very intuitive. This idea of, you know, leaving your house, going down to the square or wherever, talking to your neighbors, debating, you know, local issues, deciding what to do together in a democratic way. And actually, I'd say there's probably thousands of people around the world doing some kind of municipalism without even knowing the term. The other thing is that Barcelona en Comú, although we're municipalists, what we're doing, we're not doing anything on the level of Kurdistan. We're probably doing some sort of proto-municipalism. You know, we have representatives in City Hall. We're not using a kind of delegate, pure assembly-based model of decision-making, though we do assemblies. But I think that kind of dialogue that we're doing today between the theory and the practice is really useful. So I guess, like, the reasons when we decided to run for City Hall back in 2014, there was actually a debate in Barcelona about whether we should stand for the Spanish general elections or the local city council elections. Because after the 2008 financial crisis, there was a huge wave in Spain of social movements. Barcelona's always been a very radical, active city. There was the PA housing movement, which was a kind of assembly-based direct action movement to stop evictions. And all of these kind of networks of social movements in Barcelona and in other cities in Spain were deciding how to harness this kind of popular power at the polls. And the reason I think that we kind of intuitively ended up at the same conclusion as Bookchin about the power of local radical democracy was for a few reasons. One is it's very accessible. I think if you want to build a mass movement and actually win, everyone feels like they know and care about the neighborhood they live in, right? Even people who aren't traditionally what we'd think of as politicized people. The other thing is that municipalism is very compatible with the political culture of social movements, in the sense that the social movements, at least here, are very horizontal and assembly based, and they wanted to keep those practices and values going when they made the leap to electoral politics. And the other thing is the potential to do direct democracy, or at least participatory democracy, that the local scale provides, which the national scale doesn't. And I think the other thing that brings people to municipalism is the fact that it's useful, because it's very action-oriented. It's very based on the tangible things around us, whether that be stopping evictions, providing affordable energy, food, or indeed winning elections, because we actually did manage to win the elections here, where the left in Spain, well, at least the radical left, hasn't managed to do so over the last election cycles. But I do think that although people do come to municipalism without reading Bookchin, when I came to him after having started to do municipalism and I read Next Revolution, it was like a revelation. And I think it is really useful, once you're doing it, to have this kind of theoretical grounding and somebody to kind of paint the horizon of what might be possible over the longer term, or the kind of the utopia that we're working towards. So hopefully we can talk a bit more about that today. I'll leave it there for now.
Thanks, Kate. That was great. Hilary, what's your take on Bookchin, and how do you relate to some of the ideas in the book, and is ideas more generally? I mean, this, you know, thinking of your work, you know, there's some intersections there, as overlaps, and parts where you are obviously quite different. Tell us a little bit about how you might engage with them in terms of your books, your written works, as well as the politics that you've actually practiced in terms of the GLC and activism.
Yes. No. Okay. So when Marcus asked me about this, I grasped the opportunity, because I've been aware of Bookchin's work for a long time and kind of felt an affinity. You know, I've dipped into it, but I've not studied it, and so I thought now, particularly with lockdown, is the chance to study it. But Verso couldn't give me a copy of the book, which I need, because I find reading like a whole book on PDF isn't so good. And secondly, I found that the whole experience of the pandemic, it was so kind of, I don't know, distracting in a way, sort of making sense of what the government was doing, getting angry with what the government was doing, and then becoming interested in what alternatives, what forms of self-government people were developing in the absence of an adequate government. Anyway, so I haven't done the studying that I'd like to do. Obviously, I've read parts of the PDF, and so I want to, you know, keep engaged with you all and continue this discussion. So my sort of feeling, my attraction to Bookchin is because he's tackling this question. Well, firstly, he takes popular democracy seriously, and self-government and popular power. And I found that while at certain points a lot of the left says, you know, is expressing enthusiasm for popular participation, it's kind of not very serious. It's like slightly superficial. It's like, you know, we support popular participation, but when it comes to thinking about it and building the institutions, in the end, the old structures are the sort of default. I mean, so recently with the Labour Party and Jeremy Corbyn, you know, his promise, I mean, meaning in the broad sense of what people hoped, is that, you know, a movement came around him that wasn't from within the Labour Party, but was from social movements. And so I really hoped that now we'd have a complete sort of transformation of Labour politics, in which the social movements were taken as the creative, transformative force, which is my belief that they are. But actually, the problem was that although a lot of people would share that aspiration. The structures of the Labour Party were like a sort of, you know, they were already in existence. So it was quite an easy default for the sort of radical supporters of Corbyn to think, okay, we must take over these structures. It was like a sort of almost unconscious sort of direction of travel, rather than actually let's think about how we do develop popular power. Let's work with our local tenants groups, or you know, our or the organisations of precarious workers. I mean, some people did that. You know, like there's a strong renters union. There's a lot of really good organisation of precarious workers that was definitely inspired by the Corbyn movement. But you know, I just became aware of the sort of the power of existing institutions to sort of draw people in, and you know, people have only got so much energy, and so that kind of weight of the old and the exhausted and the kind of the institutions that are actually at a dead end, but they have a kind of weight and a residual weight that draws people in to put energy into taking them over. So I felt that Butchkin kind of like really takes the question of building popular power seriously. And that's been my kind of preoccupation, maybe partly from the student movement. I was a 68er, so participation, C. Wright Mills and so on were very much, you know, what I found attractive, you know, as a sort of alternative to both the Soviet model of socialism and to capitalism. And then the women's movement, I don't know how Butchkin relates to feminism. I mean, I think the issue isn't so much hierarchy, it's subordination, different forms of subordination, an exercise of domination that are not, that can't be reduced to class. So I agree with Blair's idea of non-reducible. I wouldn't say non-reducible forms of hierarchy, I'd say non-reducible forms of subordination and oppression. And I'd also say that what we learned in the women's movement particularly, but also, you know, parts of the base of the trade union movement, is that the existing systems of power depend on our complicity. So transformation has got to be self-transformation, and it's got to be not only a rejection, a refusal to reproduce the existing institutions, but then to develop alternatives for which one needs movements and solidarity. But then I suppose where maybe I diverge from Butchkin, or maybe it's just an area of like discussion, because I don't have a very fixed position. I feel I'm searching, you know, and experimenting or observing experiments. But I suppose maybe it's because Britain's has got this social democratic legacy, and in a way many people feel a right to the kind of governmental sphere and to public resources. And so while being quite disillusioned with the state, they also, in a way, have an inclination to kind of reclaim it. So I got involved with Radical Shop Stewards, who developed a very transformative, you know, alternative vision of production. But that was initially supported by a radical political representative, Tony Benn. And that gave them confidence and encouragement. In the end, you know, the Labour government crushed it, as did management. But that then inspired many of us to look to municipal government, where the balance of forces was more favourable, and in particular in London. So in a way, we tried to replicate that idea of a partnership between popular movements, whether it's the women's movement, the radical trade union movement, community movements, and the emerging ecology movement, and you know, and an elected state. And so one of my questions is like, what are the conditions under which that that partnership can be empowering? So I distinguish in my latest book two kinds of power. So power as transformative capacity, which is the power you can see evident in social movements, and power as domination. And normally they're in conflict, and powers domination, if that's seen as a strategy for social change, you know, ends up compromised and not transformative at all, as we've seen with social democratic governments all over the world. But power as domination, i.e. governmental power, can be a resource for power as transformative capacity. And the question is, under what conditions, you know, what makes that possible? And in the Greater London Council, this is what we tried to do with the Popular Planning Unit. We tried to use it as a resource for popular struggles around, particularly around land and around economic activity. So I probably better stop, but you know, there are lots of lessons from that experience. So I feel that's an open question. You know, we can't engage with the state as if it's some kind of answer, but can we hack it, as it were? Can we hack into it? Can we turn it into some kind of resource for transformative capacity, which is where our real power and priority has to lie? And also that's where I find the experience of Barcelona very inspiring and complicated.
There's so many things to pick up on. I wondered if we could start maybe coming back to you, Blair, by looking at, oh, Marcus is here as well, by returning to this idea of Butchins around libertarian municipalism. And, you know, Hillary was just talking about there this idea of creating some kind of political project, you know, between formal politics and social politics, the kind of the transformative power of social politics, and doing that at the local and municipal level. Could you start a bit by explaining the concept? Because it's a concept that in some ways is quite utopian, but has very kind of practical aspects to it.
Yeah, so that was really one of the key kind of threads in his political evolution that led him away from anarchism. And as I mentioned before, it was really there from his earliest writings in like the 60s when he was really talking about the forms of freedom. He was always interested in institutions. What are the institutions of a free society? It's not enough to just have ideas. And we've also obviously seen the how tarnished the revolutionary tradition was by the authoritarian experiment of the Soviet system. So he was always looking for something that put these two together. So I think actually Kate and Hillary kind of provide two interesting orientation points, because when Murray started kind of developing his idea of libertarian municipalism, the idea is to build a dual power in tension with the state. But he kind of, at least at first, articulated two different avenues. One was kind of the extra parliamentary route, where you basically call some kind of a popular assembly on your own that doesn't exist, and you build that, and that becomes kind of a new seat of legitimacy in contrast to the state. And then later, and increasingly this became his main emphasis, was an electoral route, where essentially you run candidates on the local level with the explicit aim of not only trying to, you know, get through progressive content, but to change the very form of power, to devolve that power to popular assemblies. So this became kind of the governing idea of libertarian municipalism, of breaking down power, changing our conception of politics as something that is done to us as passive objects by a professionalized class of politicians with their own interests set apart and against that of society at large, to something we do together collectively, an empowering act of, I think Kate said something we do together to empower ourselves. So in this, he really returned back to this kind of classic Athenian model, despite all its limitations of being a slave society, patriarchal, et cetera. He was very aware of that. He thought there was something in this experience of direct democracy that the left had really overlooked. So, I mean, this also interestingly brought him into some conflict with other figures that would go on to national prominence, specifically Bernie Sanders. You know, they were both living in Burlington, Vermont at the same period. They're both, you know, radical Jews from New York City. Interesting factoid, actually, Debbie Bookchin, my co-editor, was Bernie Sanders' press secretary for 4 or 5 years. So there's a long history of the two families. But Murray and his crew in Burlington were very, very critical of Bernie's attempts to kind of, you know, enter into the halls of power at higher levels to change things, because they saw basically one example was an attempt to develop the Burlington waterfront there, which left Greens opposed successfully, and which now if you go there is a really beautiful park, which Sanders was against at that time. And another example they often pointed to, the kind of the self-perpetuating realpolitik, that there is a local weapons manufacturer that makes Gatling guns there for warships, and Sanders consistently defended these as good, well-paying union jobs. So he was really insisting on the utopian of this. And it wasn't the utopian impulse here. And it wasn't just that he was some ideological anarchist, but this was also rooted in his analysis of history, that time after time, movements that entered into state power with the intention of changing the world are in fact changed by them. And he was in close dialogue with the German Green Party. He was a close student of German social democracy. And then, of course, he'd seen the post-New Left groups, many of them enter into the halls of power. And so he wanted to really, he didn't want to reject that. He was criticized mercilessly by his anarchist colleagues for arguing for electoral strategy. But he wanted to not just try to legislate progressive content, but to change the very form. And that's what libertarian municipalism or communalism represents, is a different way of thinking about politics.
Kate, maybe you'd like to take up there on this idea of municipalism and the local. You mentioned it already. You obviously, you're involved in like practicing politics, you know, in this sense, and this kind of inevitable sort of compromise between strategy and principles. So is this, what can you take from Butchin's book that helps with these kind of dilemmas?
Well, I guess something that has caught my attention from what Blair said was the idea of avoiding the creation of a professional class of politicians, you know, that's disconnected from ordinary people and becomes kind of institutionalized. And the main way that Bookchin wanted to deal with that was by having a system of delegation. So the idea that your representatives are just delegates, and actually the decisions that are taken by the assembly and the elected people just obey what the assembly says. I mean, in practice, although I agree with the goal, and actually we have some mechanisms to try and avoid that kind of political class problem, one of which is term limits, because it's one thing being in City Hall for 4 years or 8 years, and it's another being in elected politics for 20 or 30 years. And the other thing is salary limits, because materially, at least in Spain, the official salaries of elected politicians are absolutely disconnected from ordinary people's salaries. But the thing about the delegate system is that, I mean, I find it very utopian and kind of, I mean, practically very difficult to actually do, because especially if you're in government, because the idea of taking every single decision back to an assembly is kind of like, how do you even have the material time to do that? And so I guess my question would be, which decisions should be taken back to the assembly, and which decisions can be left to a kind of broad mandate in which the individual decisions, as long as they're following that broad mandate, can be made by the people who get into power. Because I think there's an issue on the left, which is that there's a big concern about holding electeds to account, which is obviously very important, and we've seen many examples of why it's important. But there's also this idea that when people take office or get into power, that they're immediately corrupted or driven, you know, mad by power. And actually, at least at the beginning, most of them are the same people they were before. They're just in a different situation with different limits. And actually what they need from their assembly or their movement is support, not a kind of constant quest for, to control every little thing they're doing. So yeah, I think that is a place where the theory kind of hits against reality, in my experience, at least.
Hilary, that seems like a good opportunity to reflect on. Obviously, you've written about transforming the state and this kind of thing, but you were also involved, of course, in the GLC, and I know you've talked about it a lot of times, but it seems like a good opportunity to explain a little bit about what happened when people like you and Doreen Massey became involved in the GLC and dealt with some of these issues of exercising power from the left or trying to develop kind of popular forms of democracy at community and kind of local city level.
Yes, I can say something building a bit on what Kate said. I mean, I think for us, the key thing was to strengthen, you know, popular movements. In a way, it was like, for us, it was also like, where are the decisions coming from? So where is the proposals? I mean, we were, the GLC, I wasn't a councillor, I was an official, well, a politically appointed official coordinating this popular planning unit. But the councillors and this radical bit of the Labour Party were elected on the basis of quite a detailed manifesto. But I think now this is a key thing. I think that's where electoral democracy can play a role in sort of gaining societal or citywide legitimacy for a strategy. But then there's the question of implementation. And there it seems crucial to recognize that you cannot rely on the state institutions, that state institutions are either often embedded with corporate and private interests, or in our case, they were actually very weak because the national government, Thatcher's government, had steadily eroded those powers. And so, for example, well, this meant actually that the GLC, the politicians, depended on the movements to implement their policies because, you know, the movements had a power which they lacked. So this happened around the question of land development. And obviously London has very high value land, particularly inner city land. So one classic example I can give to illustrate the point is that there was an area down near the river, very valuable, near the city too. And it was a residential area, you know, small businesses, you know, just a very, you know, a local neighbourhood. And then before the GLC, a big property developer put in a bid and was going to develop it effectively a speculative office block. So a local campaign developed, and some of the people who then became councillors were in this campaign. And it was a very powerful campaign in terms of ideas and an imaginative alternative for developing the inner city community, you know, that won a lot of popular support. And then several of the people involved decided, well, you know, we think we need support, political support. We need some resources, we need some legislative support. So they became councillors. They joined the radical Labour Party sort of slate of councillors. But when they were in there not as delegates formally, but as, you know, as champions of this struggle. So they weren't, you know, they were probably in regular contact, weekly contact, because that was their life. They lived there. They were rooted there, and so they would be coming back to the assembly of this community. But the decisions and the demands and the ideas were coming from the assembly, from the local people. And so in a way, it wasn't about accountability. It was about responding to the demands and the power of the community. And I think that's a better way to see it. So it's not so much delegates, it's more that the emphasis is on supporting that power and then taking decisions, which in a way are about enabling that power to be realized. So the key decision was to for the GLC to buy the land, you know, to use powers of compulsory purchase, and then hand over the land to the trust set up by the community. So it was like a sort of collaboration rather than a delegate structure. It was like an active collaboration. Similarly, with the creation of nurseries led by the Women's Committee. Again, you know, the GLC didn't have the capacity to create nurseries, but there were masses of self-organized groups across the city. So the position of the GLC was to support those groups coming together, develop their plans, and then unleash resources from the GLC to support that popular power. But again, the creativity, the decisions came from the assemblies around childcare, and they were supported by the GLC. And it wasn't so much delegates, it was a collaborative relationship. I'm not quite sure how that would fit with Butchkin. I mean, in a way, it's taking the spirit of what he's saying, but looking at slightly different institutional forms. So it's recognizing the need for institutions, but recognizing that the locus of transformative capacity lay with the movements, but that the elected council had got resources that it could deploy in support of those movements. But for that to happen required a collaborative relationship.
I think exactly Butchkin was trying to navigate those two poles and to try to offer a vision of how you can avoid the problems of representation, avoid the problems of, you know, this common sense of betrayal on the part of social movements by politicians, by changing not just the political content, but the form. I would say that you know, somewhat agonistic relationship to quote unquote leaders is the right one and a good one. Of course, they deserve support, but I think they also are under incredible pressure to conform to the dictates of states long molded to the imperatives of power, and especially capital in big cities. So they really need that. And that, to me, that's why also like this, seeing them as representatives or delegates or tribunes is problematic. There need to be institutionalized forms of accountability and communication. And that's the point of assemblies, is to do that, to create a space where that happens. It's not just taking on faith. And we can point to a lot of, I mean, not great examples of that happening, but I'm thinking of, like, you know, we have Kashama Savant here in Seattle, who's a socialist city council person, and she's been great on a whole host of issues. But, you know, they basically come up with these platforms in their, you know, fairly sectarian groups, socialist alternative that very few people can even become a member of. In fact, I have comrades that tried to get in and they're like, no, you have to go and read more Lenin, Marx, Mao, whatnot. So just changing the form as well as the content, or the same thing. I mean, you could see similar impulses at work in the Sanders campaign. His slogan, he started right out of the gate saying, not me, us. And when he announced this most recent candidacy, he said, even if I am elected, I am hemmed in institutionally on all sides. I cannot do this on my own. Don't put all your faith in me. We need a mass movement to put pressure on all levers of society to make this happen. So that was a pretty startling recognition of the limitations of simply getting elected. And we have other historical examples from, you know, Mitterrand in France in the 80s, you know, pretty transformative socialist agenda, and then massive capital flight. And then he becomes one of the handmaidens of neoliberalism. Same thing with the PT in Brazil. You know, if you look across the globe, it was actually social democratic parties that in many cases were the good cop that were responsible for undermining whatever vestiges of social democracy were there. So to me, just thinking of it in terms of like parties and representation perpetuates that, because it's not a personal failing. It's not these are bad people that sell out. They're real institutional pressures. So unless we're thinking about changing those institutions, will usually be changed by them. And so I think some of this can be terminological. Murray was very much against the idea of the state, which, as I said before, he saw as this professionalized class above and against society. But when we start talking about confederalism and the relationship of administration versus policymaking, this was a core distinction for him. He thought the power needed to flow from the bottom up, that it should start, you know, in assemblies, and that each level, as it kind of expanded in concentric circles, there needed to be strictly recallable and mandated. He did use the term delegates, but that they were not, you know, the creation of a new professionalized class, and that movements needed to hold their feet to the fire on this score at all times. I agree, though, that there are complicated practical questions of what this looks like, especially in a neoliberal world where we're all working longer and harder and we have less time to ourselves. So, of course, this was embedded in a broader politics of anti-capitalism attempting to build a post-scarcity society, that we need more time for politics. So to me, that's also one of the important, exciting elements of, you know, Right to the City movements, is using cities as kind of a popular stage to highlight the class interests at work of the states and of capital. And we're doing that in Seattle with, you know, Amazon. This is transforming the city, throwing people out. And we've seen, you know, even before the current uprising against white supremacy, we've seen a series of movements and struggles that have really tried to spotlight just how much the state acts as the beacon of the 1% against the 99%. And what's really exciting right now with this uprising against white supremacy that's happening nationally and indeed globally is that they're combining materialist demands rather than symbolic ones. For example, to defund the police, they're deciding these things in terms of, in popular assemblies, they're saying, okay, if we defund the police, what do we want to do with this money? Let's talk about it. And I was at the Capitol Hill organized protest or autonomous zone last week, and I sat in on one of these assemblies, and it was being moderated by a Duwamish tribal elder. There were Duwamish dancers, you know, kind of providing this amazing vibe. And here we're just having a conversation, the people that live in that neighborhood, what would we want to do with the money that hopefully will not go back to this empty police station that we're camped out in front of? Where would these, you know, millions of dollars go? And that to me is like a perfect example of the kind of communalist dual power that we want to create.
If we look at contemporary societies characterized by a highly differentiated social division of labor, fast changing, fast knowledge transfers and so forth. So how can we think about instituting a direct democracy without overwhelming people? I mean, people need to have the capacities in movements to process the issues, the process, the demands, and to become involved. So how does Murray Bookchin help us thinking through this question of complexity and overwhelmingness?
I guess that's for me. In fact, this is literally where chapter 4 of the book, The Meaning of Confederalism, starts. He basically says, few arguments have been used more effectively to challenge the case for face-to-face participatory democracy than the claim that we live in a complex society. And he goes on. He has a couple different points he makes. On the one hand, he's trying to avoid the kind of argument for centralized nationalization, the kind of classic Marxian imaginary, on the one hand. And on the other hand, he's also very, very aware of the limits of localism that can lead to a parochialism. So he's really trying to kind of navigate those through this concept of confederalism. And so one of the first points he makes is, yes, the world is very complex. One of those problems is the kind of false complexity and redundancy of capitalism. So this is bound up in the kind of anti-capitalist ethos. In fact, we probably don't need, I mean, we will need global supply chains, but we probably don't need them in the same way, in the same scale that we have them now, that we want to start to, you know, source more of these things locally, to produce things in a sustainable way. There's so many inefficiencies that are basically made imperative by capitalism. And to give one example is, I don't know if anyone suffered through that terrible recent documentary, Planet of the Humans. It's really Malthusian garbage, but a lot of it is a screed against, it was financed by Michael Moore, so it had a lot of publicity. But it's basically a critique of renewable energy. And it's saying how it's like impossible to do this, it would require more and more mining. But the point is, actually, you can reclaim a lot of the metals and the materials that you need. It's just inefficient to do so under capitalism. So this was kind of part of the logic of his critique, that you get trapped in these existing ways of thinking about things. Of course, there are real institutional barriers to doing that. So I think another thing is he definitely harkens back to the early Marx and this desire for a more well-rounded life. He's definitely not saying we need to undo the division of labor, but I think he is saying that we want a more diverse, flexible life of, you know, hunting in the morning, poetry in the evening, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so we will sacrifice some specialization in form of generalization, but a lot of that is mandated again by capitalism. But I think important to this also is that not everyone needs to be an expert either. That, you know, direct democracy sets the general parameters that are then carried out by, you know, delegates or administrators. So we're not all going to be making decisions on, you know, how the sewers run, but we want to make sure that they follow a broad set of, you know, ecological, democratic, humane values.
Yes, I mean, it's something I haven't really worked out, but it's responding to this challenge of how do the demands and the ideas of popular movements actually become realized within the or get the support they need from the political system? How do we avoid the emergence of a separate political class or the sort of absorption of those demands within the local state? And I mean, I'm just wondering whether actually delegation versus representation is the key issue. For me, the key issue is the power and autonomy of the popular assembly and the not just the assembly, sorry, I've got a dry throat. Not just the assembly, but the forms of material life that the assembly kind of brings together. And that actually, in terms of complexity, the assembly doesn't need to know, I mean, it needs transparency, but it doesn't, you know, the complexity of a municipal government, let's say this example of London and the place near the Thames, it doesn't need to know all the legal complexities of compulsory purchase. It just needs to know that that's going to happen. And so, in a way, it's a question of the power of the assembly. And, you know, that power can be exercised not simply through making a delegate accountable, but through taking action. Like, so, in the GLC, if the councillor who was involved in this campaign in the end compromised around the compulsory purchase action, this campaign would have occupied the town hall. You know, so I think one's got to see popular power as being primarily about a positive dimension, not simply about being the recipient of accountability.
Kate, did you want to come in there?
Yeah, just two really simple ideas. I mean, I think the first thing is that participation and direct democracy doesn't mean that everyone participates in everything all the time. And I think Blair's already pointed to this, but actually it's about people having the opportunity to participate in the questions that interest and affect them. So that's one. And the other is that in order to buy that idea and that strategy, you have to profoundly believe in people's capacity to understand the world around them, understand their own interests, and also understand and take into account the collective interest of the community around them. And I think that a lot of people on the left, although they might buy the headline, when it actually comes down to it, they don't have a faith in ordinary people's capacity for self-government. And actually, when they come across people who aren't involved in radical left politics and they say things that, you know, they don't like, they suddenly get much more wary about participation. So you have to really have nerves of steel, you know, to go down this path.
Yeah, I think that really links back to some of the things that Hilary was saying earlier in relation to the UK context and the Labour Party, past and present. Thinking more about this, so staying at the local or urban level, but linking to this idea of transnationalism, confederalism, and things like that. as obviously as a theory, it sounds quite utopian, and we don't necessarily have to go into all aspects of it. But it's obviously something that seems to be important now in the current context with fearless cities and the development of links between places, between cities. And it's something that obviously is not new. It has been trans municipalism in the past. So I don't know, Blair, if you want to start perhaps with telling us a little bit about Buchan's ideas there, and then maybe relating that to some of your own experiences. And then we can move on to Kate and Hillary again.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, Buchan didn't write too extensively on the question of like international confederation. It was more of there as like a principle. And he often referred to, as you said, the history of the workers' movement being highly international. And that was, of course, before we had all these amazing tools. Of course, we also have the experience of things like the World Social Forum that were, you know, prefiguring some of these kind of global forms of democracy. Really, I mean, it is, I think, we don't have a lot to work with. And I think that's really unfortunate. And it strikes me as very strange that, again, compared to the workers' movement of 150 years ago, I think movements today, despite all these tools, are less connected in some ways than they were in the past. And I think that's a real limitation. So that's a real pressing task for us. How do we build those? How do we build those forms? What do they look like? I think there is already some, obviously, levels of discursive resonance and also some, you know, collaboration. But, you know, for example, the global municipalist movement, people are following what's happening in Barcelona. They're looking at the Symbiosis Network in North America. They're looking at Rojava. They're looking at Cooperation Jackson in the South. So one of the initiatives that's been launched out of the Institute in recent years is the Symbiosis Confederation, which is an attempt to build exactly those linkages between movements and groups, at least in North America, that are working within kind of a dual power understanding of creating directly democratic institutions, a cooperative economy, and to begin building those linkages so we can coordinate across, you know, nations. And right now it's in North America, but we just had a great week-long summer school with people from India, Tanzania, Tasmania, across Europe, across North America, Brazil, Mexico, and there was a lot of interest in, you know, building on these. And of course, this is happening in various other places and movements. But yeah, I don't think there's a book should offer some ideas, but it's not a roadmap.
Kate, would you want to come in on that?
Yeah, just at the beginning, I said that we don't need to read Buchan to start doing municipalism, but once we do, it's really useful to read his work. And one of the reasons is this one, because when we won the elections in Barcelona, or even before when we decided to stand for office, one of the first questions or criticisms that you get is, but you can't overthrow global capitalism from one town. And, you know, city councils have very limited resources and limited powers. And, you know, it's a drop in the ocean. And actually, what people say is that you have to take over national government. You know, that's the only way to really make any kind of sizable, significant change. And actually, the idea of being able to win multiple towns, cities, regions, and kind of network them together as a potential counterpower to both the state and capitalism, at least provides an alternative way of imagining the world, because although the nation state is relatively new, it's something that it seems is very difficult to imagine alternative ways of exercising power or of governing any space that's larger than a single city. So having that that idea in mind and realizing the importance of those networks and of the potential for scaling out. I do think there's a tendency to jump to the global very quickly. I mean, actually, what you'd really want is the kind of Kurdish model where you kind of gradually take over a region. Because, I mean, I'm sure if managing assemblies in one neighborhood or one city is already super complicated. Networking them together and taking joint decisions, even at a regional level, I'm sure is 10 times more complicated. So, you know, we don't want to run before we can walk. But like I say, it's really useful to have had somebody think through the consequences of that local approach.
Okay, I mean, I very much agree with Kate, and in a way, it's also about, I mean, a kind of national federations. And I think all I'd add to what Kate says is, I think the importance of what I'd call productive democracy, that is, you know, actually collaboration in producing things, in doing things. So, you know, you've got the networks that have survived around from the social forums have often been networks about actually, you know, doing something, producing new social relations. So the whole issue of refugees, you know, and you know, the organization of squats and then solidarity with squats, like, you know, the I can't remember what it was called, the place in Athens that was an amazing kind of alternative space for refugees, but it depended on a lot of material support from Germany in particular. And then you've got networks around, at least at a national level in the UK, you've got networks around local energy production, sort of municipal energy, and they're actually materially helping each other. And in Latin America, less so now because of the sort of move away from the left, but there were a lot of what they call public-public partnerships around water, the running of municipal water systems.
One topic that also is, of course, very current or very urgent, has always been very urgent, of course, and that relates to now the issue raised by the Black Lives Matter and the question of racism. And it kind of struck Ross and me when reading Bookchin's work that Bookchin apparently has a great hope or great optimism about the capacity of reasoning. You know? Looking at one of the chapters in this book, The Next Revolution, it's called Cities, the Unfolding of Reason in History. So given this, I mean, first of all, is that a true way of framing this and great optimism in reason, which obviously is not shared by many other philosophers or social theorists and so forth, who are much more skeptical about the capacity of reason. And then, of course, specifically the question, how would this reason or this reasoning capacity be capable of combating racism or other forms of social division, sexism, ableism?
A great question. So he was always very clear that decentralization and even direct democracy alone weren't magic bullets, that each alone could be insufficient. On page 74, he says, at the risk of seeming contrary, I feel obliged to emphasize that decentralization, localism, self-sufficiency, and even confederation, each taken singly, do not constitute a guarantee that we will achieve a rational or ecological society. In fact, all of them have at one time or another supported parochial communities, oligarchies, and even despotic regimes. Clearly, institutional changes don't occur in a social vacuum, nor do they guarantee blah, 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 all these good things. But libertarian municipalism is premised on the struggle to achieve a rational and ecological society, a struggle that depends on education and organization. So what does that mean concretely in terms of addressing racism and sexism? I think rather than kind of focusing on just like idealist changing ideas, although that's there, he really stressed actually confederation as an anti-racist and anti-parochial praxis, that political and economic interdependence creates these actual ties of engaging with other communities, other groups, and creates, you know, concrete shared needs and demystifies, you know, difference. This was always tied to, you know, his love for the Greek paideia concept of public education through public deliberation. So he definitely had a, we could say like a quasi-Habermasian streak there,
but understood this in terms of actual political struggle. And so this was, and just to go back to the role of cities, I don't know if that was like a naive view of city, but rather a historical one in identifying cities as a material locus for breaking down these parochial ties of blood and tribe, increased freedom that came from anonymity, exposure to difference and social intermingling, and new potentialities for freedom. It wasn't to say this is a teleology, this has to happen, but there was an important like material and spatial place that, you know, really was kind of historically novel. So this is, it's not an accident, I guess, that he focuses on that. And he, I mean, just one more quote, he says, do these interdependencies and majority decisions guarantee that a majority decision will be a correct one? Certainly not. But our chance for a rational and ecological society are much better in this approach than in those that ride on centralized entities and bureaucratic apparatuses.
Can I agree? Can I say something?
Sure, Hillary, go ahead.
Okay, so I agree very much with Blair, and I would, I mean, maybe not qualify, but sort of just ask what's included in the rational. I mean, sometimes the rational is counterposed to the emotional or to the tacit, you know. So I think it's important to recognize the importance of experience. So, I mean, if you think about the women's movement, the way we developed many of our ideas, which, you know, were, I mean, I'd say, you know, they were rational, they were the basis of new institutions, but they came out of what we called consciousness raising groups, which is where women came together and they exchanged experiences. And, you know, often they were quite emotional because the experiences had produced emotions and remembering them was emotional. And, but out of that came a sort of sharing of what people call tacit knowledge, you know, things that you can't always say, but you know, and that sharing that kind of produced a kind of ability to articulate and then to kind of turn that tacit knowledge into knowledge that was the basis of new institutions like rape crisis centres, new strategies towards healthcare. Obviously, the legacy of Paulo Freire is important and maybe needs to combine with the legacy of Murray Bookchin. But that idea of a form of education that builds on people's existing capacity. I mean, I do agree with Kate that the left, I mean, it's a bit implicit in Lenin, that sort of vanguard notion that, you know, that there needs to be a level of sort of theoretical intervention from the outside rather than you know, a sort of spirit of inquiry and investigation. I mean, you know, there was a good tradition in the Italian left of inquiry and sharing of experience. So it's not absent from the left, but it's more dominant in social movement thinking, including in the anti-globalization movement, than in sort of the traditional organizations of the left that tended to make rational a rather narrow definition that assumed theory was, you know, the prime moment in the production of knowledge.
Yeah, I completely agree with Hillary there. And it's something that has always grated slightly with me with Bookchin is the rational idea. And I mean, maybe I'm not understanding it exactly the way he meant it, but I do think that this idea that rational thought is superior to other forms of knowledge is dangerous, because it's not the same a politics that's driven by love to one that's driven by envy, and terrible things have been done in the name of supposed rationality. But on the issue of racism and sexism, I think there's also something that we have to be aware of, which is that if we open up participatory spaces and popular assemblies, that initially they're going to reproduce the social hierarchies of society. And actually, like, easier than curing everyone of sexism and racism, it's actually important to have kind of very practical mechanisms in place to ensure that whatever people's prejudices or whatever, that that at least they can be counteracted by, I don't know, like one of the things that we do is we try and have gender equal assemblies, and we also try and make sure that women speak for the same amount of time as men, because we realized after a while that it wasn't enough to have an equal number of both sexes in the room, but you actually had to make sure that that women spoke as much of the time as men, or having childcare available, or you know, taking into account that that different kind of people, for whatever reasons, for all of their diversity, might find debating or decision making to be better done in one way or another. So not everyone's comfortable standing up and speaking, doing a speech in front of an assembly of hundreds of people. Some people might want to do smaller groups. Some people feel better expressing their ideas in writing or in other ways. So kind of actually building in structures that allow the diversity of citizens or people or whoever, activists, to contribute and to try and reduce, because all of these systems of hierarchy are so ingrained in all of us that unless we take active steps to deactivate them, that they'll be there with us even in radically democratic spaces, or especially.
I'm really happy that you joined us today and took your time, so thank you very much.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter.